Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thanks for tuning into the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you on this steamy summer day from the wonderfully cozy and mercifully air-conditioned studio in the back of Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And you are listening to Good Food, the show where we talk with people who are using food as a vehicle for social good. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I am so happy to be joined today by Sebastian Nesqueris, an inaugural Food Corps service member and fellow, and a recent recipient of a supply chain fellowship through the School of Business at North Carolina State University, which in a small and very crude nutshell, fosters work to build and strengthen the businesses that support small and medium scale farms. Clearly that kind of critical work can't really be described in the one sentence that I just tried to describe it with. So Sebastian, we'll leave that to you. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on your show, Daniel.
It's my pleasure. So, first question, it's like almost 100 degrees here in New York today. How's the weather down in North Carolina where you are?
Well, we might be actually a little bit cooler than you are today. We have some real fat drops of rain.
Hey, good for you guys.
Yeah. Does it smell like garbage being dragged across the pavement and then baked into, like, garbage omelets? Is that what it smells like right now in New York?
Well, we're in Roberta's, so the garbage omelets are top-notch here. But outside, yeah, you might be right.
That's awesome.
So first of all, congratulations on your upcoming fellowship. That's really fantastic news, and it sounds like quite a program. So that's really great. So I want to start with Food Corps. Can you tell us what it was like to be in the very first class of Food Corps, and for those who might not know what you know, how Food Corps was conceived and what its mission is?
Yeah, totally. It might help to explain what it was like to be in that first class if I took maybe a moment to tell you how I got there. Can I do that?
Absolutely.
So in the few years sort of previous to joining up with Food Corps, I was on sort of a mission to find a really top-notch, sustainable farming model.
Mm-hmm.
And so that took me, fortunately, to Italy for a while, where I was able to work for Men and Nuncio Marcelli. Took me around Spain, and I realized that I was looking for that in the States. So I was pretty fortunate to land a cooking job in New York City, which helped me actually identify a whole bunch of awesome potential farms in the kind of greater New York area. And eventually I found this farm called Flying Pigs Farm, which I know you know pretty well.
Yes, sir.
And I got to work with this fellow, Mike Yezzi. And Mike Yezzi's the head of Flying Pigs Farm. And Flying Pigs Farm really became like the role model for me, like the paramount of what high-quality, sustainable agriculture could be in the States. It was awesome working with him.
So when you say, let me interrupt you for one second. When you say you were out seeking you know, a model for sustainable farming, were there particular attributes that you were seeking out, or is it sort of a general sense that you were looking for?
That is a great question. There were particular attributes that I was really looking for. When mm-hmm. it came to livestock, I was looking for somebody who was really rotating their animals around.
Okay.
Someone who had great attention to the quality of their product. And I was looking for someone who is sort of a farmer entrepreneur role model, and that's really Mike Yezzi is not only an amazing farmer, but he's great at connecting his product to really a myriad of markets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, top restaurants in New York, top farmers markets in New York, straight off the gate sales. So that was awesome.
Yeah.
Found that practice, and a really interesting thing happened. You know, I was able to, I think it was actually a day, you might have even been there. I was at the farmer's market in Union Square, and I just helped finish set up the farmer's market, and I was approached by two neighborhood kids who were in neighborhood public school, middle school kids with a video camera, and they asked if they could interview me. I was like, sure. And so they asked me some real lowball questions, and then they finally looked at me and they asked me whether or not they could afford our products.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried desperately to give them all these kind of answers about like externalities and farm subsidies. But I realized during that period of trying to give them answers that, you know, that all that stuff aside, no, they couldn't afford that stuff.
And yeah,
that was a real issue. You know, I realized that I believe that everyone should be able to afford the quality and the sustainability of our products. But then the question became, how in the world do we do that?
Right.
So luckily, during this period of time, somehow divinely, also sort of known as Good Foods Jobs, pointed me in the direction of Food Corps starting out.
Yeah.
And when I saw what they were trying to do when they were launching that first year, I was like, man, this is it. You know, it's not the end all, but this is most definitely the next step. So what is Food Corps, I guess, is the next part of your question.
What is it, and what, you know, what about the work that they were promising
to
do really sort of sucked you in based on your set of interests and goals?
Yeah. So Food Corps is a nationwide team of leaders that connects kids to real food, and it helps them grow up healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Food Corps places these emerging kind of food system leaders in limited resource communities for a year of public service, where they conduct hands-on food education, they build in 10 school gardens, and they facilitate getting high-quality local food into public school cafeterias. So you can kind of think of it as the Peace Corps of the American school lunch program.
Okay.
We are based on...
That's a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah, it's helpful sometimes. We're based on three sort of mutually reinforcing pillars of service, and that's knowledge, engagement through school gardens, and this local sourcing, which we call access.
Mm-hmm.
So this year we're actually going to be in about 15 states, and the way that we work is each state has a real high-capacity nonprofit that works as a host site.
Okay.
And then those host sites help us find these smaller grassroots organizations that are connected to public school systems, and that's where we station Food Corps service members. So that first year, I was selected to serve in North Carolina. Our host site is the Center for Environmental Farming Systems and 4-H. And I was stationed with a woman named Kathy Byron in Moore County, North Carolina.
Okay.
So does that kind of explain...
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And what part of the state is Moore County in?
Moore County is, if you know where the Research Triangle is,
right,
it's about an hour and a half south,
and
it's in the
cities.
Center of the state in what we call the Sand Hills.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what is that place like, you know, demographically, agriculturally, culturally even, and why... Why is it the sort of place that could really benefit from the kind of work that you were brought in to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Moore County is a pretty rural county. As I said, it's in the Sand Hills, which is an ancient ocean that people now live in. Pretty wild. It is a pretty accurate actual microcosm of the country in some ways. So on the one side, you have... the Moore County, which is known for Pinehurst. Pinehurst is this sort of affluent community. It's housed the U.S. Open.
Oh, right. Big golf,
really
big country club there.
Really expensive, like, yeah, it's got golf, it's got horses, it's got mowed lawns, a lot of high-end retirement communities. But then across the tracks in Moore County, you have the fifth most rapidly impoverishing county in the country, a county
really?
That's lost most of its manufacturing, and a county where really most of the farmers were tobacco farmers. The bottom dropped out of tobacco, and now they're really trying to figure out new markets to enter and new things to grow. So it's a pretty interesting place. I was placed, as I said, with a maverick named Kathy Byron, who's one of the most incredible and passionate women in good school food.
So you guys were presumably tasked with growing a vegetable garden for the dining room at the country club, right?
That's actually what we did. We didn't even work with kids. We worked with retirees teaching golf.
Sorry, to interrupt.
No, not at all. A lot of people make that mistake. I totally understand.
Okay, so you were working with Kathy, and what were you tasked with thrown into that scenario? What did they have you do?
Totally. So I was working with this woman, Kathy Byron, out of Good Food Sand Hills. Kathy had actually already helped build about, I think, like 7 school gardens, and had made that connection with a number of different public schools in the area. And what she'd realized in her work was she could get kids to eat really anything in the school garden, but she was losing them when they left the school garden, either to go home or to go to the cafeteria. So she saw that like her next steps were going to be either to work on what's served at home, which is a real uphill battle,
mm-hmm.
or to start looking at maybe moving into working to support the school lunch program. So she really believed in local food as a great answer to that, and she started taking the steps towards working on supporting the cafeteria. But she realized that in North Carolina, in order to get your local farmers into institutional market, like a public school or a hospital or a prison or the army, they have to be GAP certified. So this is like this certification called Good Agricultural Practices.
Okay.
That's a whole nother call. But she realized that if she wanted to make this connection, she had to work on getting her local farmers GAP certified.
And what kind of, you don't have to obviously describe the whole process, but what kind of, you know, is it an incredibly arduous and onerous certification for farmers to get? Is it quick and easy?
It is time consuming, and it can be expensive.
Uh-huh.
I would say that, you know, folks are really working on making it much more efficient and much cheaper, and there's cost shares, but it is time consuming, it's expensive, and there's a 1-year window. So every year you have to be recertified. And so if you're not finding markets, it's a nightmare. So what she did was she saw sort of the barriers, and she secured this pretty sweet grant from Blue Cross Blue Shields of North Carolina Foundation to get 5 more county farmers trained. She got them trained with the help of some awesome extension agents,
uh-huh.
but none of them wanted to get certified because they didn't have any assured markets. No market was a guarantee for them. Like, the schools didn't say they were definitely going to buy it, so they were like, what's the point? So finally, she sweet-talked one of them into getting certified, and the rest were just sort of watching him to see if it was worth their while.
Okay.
And for a long time, it really wasn't. So that's this kind of stalemate is what I arrived into. And so during that first year, really what I did was I taught about, I think by the end of the year, about 3,000 kids in school gardens and cooking classes.
Wow.
In classrooms. But then I also spent a lot of time working to get this farmer's produce into Moore County schools. So that's the kind of stuff that I was tasked with when I got to Moore County.
At the school, how receptive was the school and the kids and, you know, the parents or the whole community to your presence there? Was it something that was really welcomed, or did it seem out of place? How were you received when you got there?
I think the kids were psyched.
Yeah.
You know, here's this kid who'd farmed hogs and done some cooking, and his language was never bad, but he used pretty good language in what seemed like a bad way sometimes, which was like mind-blowing to them. And we worked outside and we got dirty and they were learning at the same time.
Yeah.
And the teachers were really receptive because they were like, oh man, here's some new techniques. They also taught me a whole lot. It's not like I taught them all that much.
Right.
Some of these folks are incredible teachers. But, you know, I think to really explain that, it might help to talk to you about how maybe we connected this produce to some of these schools. Because I think through that, you can really see maybe what the receptivity looked like.
Okay, that's perfect. We're just at the time where we need to take a quick break. As soon as we get back, we'll talk about your experience with the farmer. We're talking with Sebastian Nascaris. We'll be back to you in just a second.
No trouble tonight.
This one's called Let It Go by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
So nice and tight.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Just let it go now. Let's talk it over.
We are back. You're listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network, and we've been talking with Sebastian Nascaris about when we left off. He had just entered in to Moore County, North Carolina, as an inaugural member of Food Corps, and he was telling us about sort of the scenario that he leapt into, teaching kids gardening and cooking at schools and working with local farmers to help get them their produce into the school lunch program. So that's where we left you. So tell us, who were you working with? Who was the farmer? What did they farm, and how did that go? How did you get him to sort of expand his market and get into the school systems?
Yeah. So when I first got to Moore County, the first thing I really did was sit down with the child nutrition director, who's basically the gatekeeper of the school lunch program mm-hmm. in the county. And so we sat together for 3 hours, which is pretty incredible considering she's one of the hardest working people in that county.
Yeah.
And we identified all the hurdles facing local procurement. So we realized, like, okay, there's some huge barriers, right? There's not enough time for people to prepare this farm fresh produce. So there's also not the skills necessarily or the facilities. There's liabilities in storage. There were storage restraints, getting it the price that she wanted. Also, the school was held to like a 1-year bid.
Uh-huh.
So if you're not in on that bid, it's really hard to get new providers. So there were all these hurdles.
So just so before you go forward, I'm sure everybody has some sense of what the existing school lunches that you were working with might look like. But will you just give us a quick rundown of what was there and what you were trying to change about it?
Yeah, I'm first and foremost, this is in no way a slight on school lunch programs. I mean, the food that was served, I did a lot of time celebrating the great items that were on that menu.
Yeah.
And what we were interested in doing is, where possible, increasing the amount of fresh and, whenever possible, local produce could be on those menus.
Yeah.
So, you know, due to cost, a lot of that stuff was coming from across the country. So what we were interested in was connecting Moore County sweet potatoes.
Okay.
To these lunches. That was my incredibly diplomatic answer to your question.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, thanks. So we identified these barriers, spent a couple weeks with it, came back and said, okay, well, if you're held to this bidding system, what would happen if we worked with your distribution company? And this child nutrition director was like, that's fine, and gave me the go-ahead to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Once I had the go-ahead to do that, I could work connecting C.V. Pilsen, who is this Moore County sweet potato farmer, just been certified, and the distributor. Now, that very act took about 2 months.
Wow.
Because C.V. Pilsen, phenomenal farmer, had not really had to interact with a new marketplace in probably about 40 years.
What's his previous market?
He was locked into a really great deal with a very large retailer who took care of most of the marketing for him.
Got it.
So getting, maybe doing this new marketing and having to be by the cell phone was not something he was really fond
mm-hmm.
of. So for 2 months, I basically had to operate like a cell phone in between these two people. Pilsen also lost one of his head sorters for a while, so I actually had to help him harvest and sort his sweet potatoes so I could bring samples to the child nutrition director and to the distributor so that they would sign off on wanting to distribute it. So we did this on and off for a while. And then after really working finally, about 2 days before Thanksgiving, we connected Pilsen's produce to Moore County schools. And then we're also able to connect Pilsen's produce to about six other county school systems because that distributor also worked with a number of other counties. So at the end of all that kind of hustle, we ended up increasing access to, I think it was about like 100,000 kids to this local produce. And as far as your question about how receptive the school was,
yeah,
you know, we got this stuff on Moore County school menus about five times last year. And so that, like, the supply part is just the first part. You know, you want to keep that supply, the kids have to eat it.
You're right.
And so that's why these other three pillars are so important within food courts, because they help support that supply as we're increasing it. So we did, you know, taste tests in gardens with teachers. Some teachers led, like, kid-generated marketing campaigns with posters. You know, we had principals. One of them
advertising
dressed up like
for the sweet potato. Wow.
It was awesome.
That's,
you know,
unbelievable.
And in the schools that were, like, hugely supportive of it, we surpassed about 80% consumption rate, which was rad.
That's amazing.
So, depending on the school, some schools were incredibly supportive. Some schools were a little less so, and it showed. But, you know, I think folks were really excited, both because it meant sort of a promise of health for their students,
mm-hmm.
but also because it meant a promise for health for local economies. And I think principals really respected that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it sounded as if it took more or less a superhuman effort on your part to make this happen, to get one sweet potato farmer's sweet potatoes into one school district and then a handful more after that. You know, looking step, which is no small potatoes, so to speak, but obviously it's just one farmer and a handful of schools. So taking a step back and looking at the big picture, how does this experience that you had very much hands-on sort of give you more insight into how this kind of work and these connections can be made on a broader scale, you know, in regions, in states, in the whole country?
Yeah.
I don't expect you to have an answer to that question, but it seems like the next logical step.
That's a really good question. To jump back a little bit, I would say if it was one person who did that, it would be a superhuman task. But it wasn't just me
right.
who did that. I did that with C.V. Pilsen, who was incredibly courageous, who took a chance on a new market and made deliveries when he maybe didn't really want to and did things out of his comfort range.
Mm-hmm.
I did that with Taylor Williams and Paige Burns, who are two of the raddest extension agents of all time ever. I did that with the help of Blue Cross and Blue Shields Foundation, the help of Kathy Byron, the help of like 200 school administrators and 12,500 kids. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That together is a superhuman power because it's a community making this kind of change. I most definitely did not do that as one individual. And maybe in some ways that in its messiness and garble is the answer to that second part of your question is, you know, to do this stuff, you have to begin to identify how to bring all those different pieces together.
Right.
And that in and of itself is also not a one-person task. That takes many people to begin to identify those resources.
So you start with small groups of people who have a goal, and then you extend them to communities, and then you widen the net and you see what you can get done.
Yeah.
So going back to your story about the farmers market and the two kids who came up to you and asked you point blank if they could, you know, afford the unbelievably great but very expensive pork that you were selling. How do you, you know, it's one thing to sustain, you know, to be able to sustain local farms and sustainable agriculture, but how do you work to ensure that those, you know, the highest quality products can be afforded by not just wealthy people, but everybody across the economic spectrum?
Oh, brother, that's a doozy of a question.
I don't expect you to have an answer to that one either.
Yeah, I have first and foremost, in defense of the price point that pork is priced at, Flying Pig's Farm is not overpricing its pork. It pays its employees very well.
Yeah.
It maintains an environmental responsibility that is really unparalleled. So it's not overpriced, it's just priced fairly. To get to your question, I mean, I think that I'm going to be trying to answer that question, hopefully, for just the rest of my life. Hopefully we get close enough to a solution that our kids will have a little bit of an easier time. But I think in some ways, you know, Food Corps is sort of a great first step to answering that, because if you look at what Food Corps is doing in many ways, is it's helping to support the supply and the demand side.
Yeah.
So on the consumer side, how do we work together to increase support of healthy food? For those of us who are involved in this stuff, how do we make sure that we are engaging as many people as possible to do that? Also, how do we ensure that the food that we're celebrating and engaging people with is priced fairly?
Yeah.
And that consumers have enough money to pay for fairly priced food, as opposed to the opposite, which sometimes happens, which is that we like drive the price of food down to make up for some pretty paltry wages.
Yeah,
on the producer side, how do we ensure that all producers, no matter what their size, have access to many different markets? You know, I think that that's the beginning of how you do this stuff. I know that's not a real definitive answer.
No, I'm not that I wasn't expecting one. But can we talk for a second about how all of those sort of half questions, half answers dovetail with your upcoming fellowship? You know, a lot of people might not think that somebody interested in you know, sustainable farming and digging around in the dirt would go run out and get an MBA, but it's I think become pretty clear based on what you've been talking about for the last few minutes that there is a really important intersection between you know, local and sustainable agriculture and business and the businesses and the markets that are essential to support it. So what you know, once you start this work, what kind of stuff will you be doing in hopes of addressing some of these things?
Let me try and figure that question out.
Or I can ask it more simply. What's your fellowship? What are you going to school for?
That's a good question. So my fellowship, I have a supply chain fellowship through the Center for Environmental Farming Systems and the Poole School of Management at NC State.
Okay.
So CEFS, which is the Center for Environmental Farming Systems, just got this first part of this $3.9 million NIFA grant to help bring local produce into more mainstream markets. So it's really trying to scale up local food supply chains by helping to support food hubs, aggregators, maybe look at some processing.
This is a grant from what organization again?
NIFA is the USDA.
Okay.
So it's a NIFA grant under the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Okay, got it.
So my fellowship is really working on both developing the business acumen and then applying it to helping to scale up local food supply chains in the state of North Carolina.
So what does it look like? What does it look like to scale up, you know, from the ground? What does it look like to take a sort of small system of local food and start to scale it up and bring it to more people? And I guess the second question in that series is how much do you scale up a local food chain before it no longer becomes local, or before it sort of outstrips the characteristics that you want it to have?
I might try and answer those backwards. I might try and go second.
Yeah, maybe the second one is more interesting anyway. You can forget about the first one. What is it about when you say a local, you know, a local food supply, what are the inherent characteristics of that you want to, you know, expand and get to more people, but at the same time, you know, not blow up too big that you lose the original quality of it?
Yeah, I'm gonna try and answer the question that I think that you're asking.
Okay.
And if it's not, then you just let me know. So for me, local food supply chains and export supply chains are not mutually exclusive. I have no problem with ultimately having really great export trade.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's important, though, is to make sure that export trade is built on very strong foundations that fulfill local needs, right? And I think that I got myself into a hole with this, but I really think that's it's not about like local being the end all of anything, but it's about making sure that no matter what you do, you are providing locally in a way that is responsible for the people who live in your community and for the land that you live on. And if you can do that really well and you figure out how to have a bit of a surplus, when we do that, I will be one of the first ones trying to create a multinational company to export those goods.
That's great. I think that that was an absolutely beautiful and perfect answer, and just at the right time because we are out of time. Sebastian, I want to thank you so much for chatting with us today. It's really a pleasure to talk with you and hear about the work that you're doing and are about to do more of. I can't wait to have you back on the show once you're a little bit into the fellowship so you can tell us all that you've learned and sort of, you know, make us a little wiser again. So you've been listening to the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I will talk to you again in a few weeks on the next episode of Good Food.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.